those little sandwich dishes. So you don't have to eat them out.
Good afternoon. We'll open the House Committee on Veteran Services and Emergency Preparedness. The day is April 30th on Tuesday, and thank you for being here. I see that we are joined with some of our honorary pages from the Senate today, so welcome, and thanks for your service in the Capitol. Are you enjoying your day? I just think it's great that we have a system that young boys and girls get a chance to kind of introduce themselves to the legislature, see what it's all about. So welcome. Hope you get something out of it today, and tell all your friends they missed out. This is a happening place. And with that, our floor session ran a little late, so did the Senate, but we want to respect the time of our Senator Prusansky, so we will get started and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 422.
Chair Matthews,
yes, please.
Members of the committee, Senate Bill 422 permits rural fire protection districts and state and local law enforcement agencies to enter into contracts for the provision of special law enforcement services.
Thank you. And Senator Prusansky, if you would, and would you like somebody to join you as well? We also have Sheriff Turner signed up. And gentlemen, you've probably been through this before, but we'll need you to just state your name for the record. We don't need your address or any of that information, but welcome to the Capitol and thanks for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Floyd Prusansky, State Senator, District 4, that includes parts of Lane and Douglas counties. And what we're going to be discussing today is Senate Bill 422 that came out of the off the Senate floor with the affirmative action. And what I want to try to do is go through a couple of things as to kind of giving you a little bit of history of how we got here and why we're here, and also hopefully lay at rest some of the concerns that have been raised since the bill has been become more known. First of all, Sheriff Turner and others within Lane County, including one of the fire districts, asked me if I would be willing to sit down with them to discuss whether or not there would be any mechanisms in place at the state level that we would allow for fire districts, rural fire districts, if they chose to do so, to be able to contract with law enforcement. Specifically, more than likely would be the local sheriff, or it could be the state police, but someone that would be within the area of jurisdiction already. When we sat down, I said, yeah, I thought this would be pretty straightforward. I actually thought we could already do it under a code within the statute section, ORS 190. We thought this would be a place where you could actually do it. But in consultation with attorneys who represent rural fire districts, they stated that they did not think it was clear enough, and they thought it was appropriate for us to ask the legislature to come forward and make it clear that it would, in fact, allow for that type of service contracts to be entered into. There was an editorial that came out of the Register of Guard on February 14th of this year that basically put forward what the measure does, and it basically says this is an opportunity to allow for rural fire districts to have an opportunity to have coverage where they would need it for providing their services. I know the chair is very familiar with first responders, and what we found is when we were going through the discussions on this, and then when I went to town halls, I went through all of my town halls, but specifically focused at the rural town halls regarding this bill, and basically putting forth what this would allow for. And everyone in that was there said that it was very important. And what I heard, which I was somewhat disturbed about, was that some of the first responders stated that because of the situations they may be asked to roll in and onto, they're very cautious and very conscious about their safety and others as to what they could or couldn't do depending on the scenario that they're faced with. Specifically, there are actually units, first responders, that will wait at the gate of the rural property until they have law enforcement available before they enter the property because the situation is not settled. There are, in fact, situations where weapons could be used against officers, or I should say first responders in the sense of fire personnel. In fact, the other part that I found very disturbing and concerning was that some of the volunteer fire department personnel actually said that when they're on the job, they're carrying Now, the question we have to ask ourselves, when we have first responders, do we want them that are there for EMTs or fire service to actually have to provide their own safety by carrying a weapon? When you talk to the boards or you talk to the chiefs of these rural fire districts, they've already stated that that is against their policy, but we know that it is, in fact, happening because they're very concerned. I think it's better to have a trained individual such as law enforcement to be part of that first responding team to actually be able to secure the facility and make sure and ensure that the individuals that are there to render aid can actually do that and not have to watch their back. So after the Register Guard editorial came out, there was a concern that was raised by some of the rural fire district chiefs that they thought that this somehow was going to impinge on their ability to carry out their services. I even asked and offered to the association representing them that we could put an amendment together, and I believe you have that amendment in front of you, the -1 amendment, that would in fact require, before any type of contracts could be entered into, that there would be a vote of the rural district as to whether or not they want to have that type of coverage to be provided, that there would in fact be requirement of those individuals in that district to actually have to pay for that service. Because as you can imagine, most rural fire districts do not have a cash flow or revenue to reserves to be able to enter in these type of contracts, because the way they are actually funded, it is for actual work as they would be doing in fire or medical personnel and capital that's necessary for including the equipment that would be used and required for doing their job. So I was told at that time that they did not think the -1, that they were comfortable with it, and speaking to the good chair, he stated that after seeing it that he'd be willing to have the public hearing today. So what I'm asking this committee to do is consider, even though there are some districts that may not want this, even though there may be some that are actually opposed to it, do we want to say across the state that other rural districts that do in fact want it? Marcola was one of the districts that actually had an affirmative when we were talking to them during our discussion that said they would like to have that option. It's another tool in the toolbox. And so we're hoping that you will also see this and to lay any fears and uneasiness to adopt the -1, because the -1 will in fact require that prior to a district entering into these agreements with a law enforcement personnel, that they have a district-wide vote and for special levy that would be required. So in a nutshell, we're not going to interfere with the money that's already coming in, that's being used to provide fire or medical services. This would require a separate vote for the individuals to actually say, yes, we want our district to enter into these contracts, and two, yes, we understand that we will be paying a special levy for those costs. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Sheriff, if that's all right, and I can wait for questions to Sheriff Turner.
Thank you, Senator. Appreciate that. Sheriff Turner.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, committee, for asking us here today that this got brought up today. My name is Tom Turner. I'm the Lane County Sheriff in Lane County, Eugene, Oregon. And one of the things that seems so crucial for this is because this idea was brought to us as an alternative. And one of the things that I'm having trouble with as the Lane County Sheriff is that we've got a very large county, 4,600 square miles. And of that 4,600 square miles, we have very few deputies that are actually patrolling that area. So our county is down to 16 to 18 hours patrol at all, and that's only among about 18 deputies. In the past, we used to have a very large state police presence, so that kind of covered us. Unfortunately, state police also has a very limited presence in any of the areas of the county. So, and it's just a, I want to make sure that I've stated this properly. Lane County has a lot of troubles patrolling their county and providing police protection of any kind. So if you wanted to get down to a numerical piece, across the West Coast and certainly in Lane County, most of the jurisdictions enjoy somewhere in the neighborhood of 1.1-ish officers per thousand. Now that varies for the county. If you look at the sheriff's offices, specifically in Oregon, they're at about 0.62 or so deputies per thousand. So it's smaller because of the geographical district. Lane County is at 0.18 deputies per thousand. It's abysmal for what we're providing for law enforcement services. The way this rubs off is that the fire departments are waiting for us to respond, and it'll take a lot of time. It takes time to get deputies or state police to these locations to assist them and keep them safe. As Senator Brzezinski has mentioned, you know, we've heard the rumors or the information about people arming themselves. We just did an active shooter exercise just this last Saturday, and I saw a number of the rural fire department people wearing ballistic vests with fire department on the outside, but they're wearing ballistic vests to the calls. Again, it's horrifying to me as a sheriff that we're not able to provide this protection. So when this idea came up from the Marcola Fire District to utilize this, or could we utilize it for deputy services or any other contract police services, that seemed like a great idea at the time. What we did is we were in the process of doing that. The way we contract services for the Lane County Sheriff's Offices, or Lane County Sheriff's Office, is a year at a time. They're yearly contracts. We do the services. We've done this for many years. That's how we would contract a service with anybody that asked us for it. As we start going through this process with the fire departments, we realize that it can't be used for law enforcement. There's a clause in the legislation at the time that says it can't be utilized for law enforcement purposes. That's why we contacted Senator Brzezinski. We worked with the fire districts, and that's why this bill was brought forward. Absolutely, it has a lot of imperfect pieces surrounding it, and we're a county that's affected by it. Other counties may be in a much better circumstance, and I suppose there could be counties that are in worse circumstances, but this looked like a possible solution to try and make something work for an area that could support it. Again, the contracts are year to year. It could even be written more restrictive than that if it didn't work out. And this just looked like an alternative. It did not look like, it was not meant for anything other than an opportunity to maybe utilize some sort of assistance in these very, very difficult economic times that many counties in Oregon are suffering, but certainly Lane County. That's where we are.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Kevin Woodworth, and I live in Springfield. I'm a retired sergeant from the sheriff's office and started in 1985 there and lived there. My mom and dad both retired from the sheriff's office. I think collectively we have about 60 years spent there, so we've got a vested interest in law enforcement in Lane County. As I kind of made my way through the sheriff's office, one of my assignments was as a patrol sergeant in Lane County. And in 1987, after the kind of the first collapse of timber money, I'm not sure, but Sheriff Burks at the time was forced to park most of the patrol cars in Lane County, and there were no patrols. And so in 1987, they started to try to get some patrol back out, and I was one of the first to come out of the jail and was sent to one of the contract cities of Oneida. And it had essentially kind of turned into the Wild West. We had a motorcycle gang move in from California, the Hessian motorcycle gang, and the methamphetamine business was running rampant. And it even got to the point with those folks out there where we came into our office one night and they'd planted a bomb at our back door. And so it was pretty crazy. And we were able to finally kind of close them down and get them out of there. And since then, Lane County has kind of tried to stabilize a certain level of patrol force out there. And so as a patrol sergeant working out of the main office, we have some contract cities as well. For me, a good night for me would be to be the patrol sergeant, have two deputies. We would divide the county in half. One would work east, one would work west. And then we just ran and ran and ran and ran. And I mean, there were nights we'd be at the top of the Willamette Pass. There'd be nights we'd be in Florence. If we had a call in one of those places, you know, it was up to me to figure out where to send people. And it's kind of been that way for a long time, but as most of you are probably aware, the federal money, the school Rural Scrolls Act, has come to a closure, and those monies are gone. And so now the sheriff isn't able to even put 24-hour patrol out there. Since I retired, I've been doing some volunteer work with the sheriff's office, and one of the programs that we've been doing is one that I did when I was a traffic sergeant. It's called Every 15 Minutes, and it's a two-day in-school teen drinking and driving program. And what it's allowed us to do is to get out into the rural areas of Lane County, into the smaller high schools, and do this program. And as we've done this, we work closely with the rural fire departments out there because they're part of this. And the common conversation that always seems to come up between the school and the fire departments and us is the lack of rural patrols. And when you have a county of 4,600, you know, it's a lot of ground to cover with two guys and a sergeant. And of course, with all the national news going on, the school shootings and all those issues, some of these small schools are really getting really nervous about, you know, what would happen if this happened at our school. And of course, you know, Thurston High School was, you know, the scene of that, one of the first schools to have a shooting situation like we've seen now on the news a number of times. And a conversation I was having this last week, we were up at Lowell High School, which is a small city just out of Eugene, and I was talking to the fire department there, and the sheriff alluded that they had an active shooter training this last weekend in Lane County, and they were, the officers of the fire department were talking about what would they do at their high school if this happened. And the conversation actually got to the point where they were considering, you know, arming themselves and responding down there because they knew that it would take so long for law enforcement to get there. And it's just kind of a scary thought. The other day I was walking into Costco in Eugene, and it kind of caught me off guard, but the guy in front of me had a 45 strapped on his belt, walking right through the door in plain sight, and we're just seeing more and more of that. And of course, Lane County was one of the counties that seemed to have got hit really hard when the timber industry came crashing down, and has never really recovered from that. I think they rank 34 out of 36 in tax revenue, and so consequently, you know, law enforcement, which is operated out of the general fund, has suffered the most. And as we've gone through these conversations, you know, we've talked about, you know, the options like Bend and some of the counties up north that have these two-tiered taxing districts. We've done some research with Deschutes County, and I've talked to those folks over there how they got that process going. Seems to be working pretty well, but it's a year-in-year process. Lane County, Leanne Richardson, the county administrator, has asked the county staff to start looking into those districts for Lane County with a 6 to 7 year time frame to where anything could get put together. And so it was actually the fire department that we started talking to that came up with this idea of contracting out with the sheriff for law enforcement. And so we sat down and we kind of started talking about it, and it just appeared to us that it might be an easy way, or the easiest way, for a short-term fix to allow those people that live in those rural fire districts to contract out for law enforcement, the same as anybody living in one of the contract cities we have. We have contracts with the Forest Service and some of those other federal agencies as well. And so we got together and talked about it. We had the fire department with us, and so they were part of this this idea. And it was merely, you know, trying to change the ORS to allow them for that law enforcement contract part in that ORS. They processed it through their fire department attorney, and so that's why we're here before you today. And essentially all it does is, you know, we know that there's a number of fire districts that don't like the idea. You know, their feeling is that there's other mechanisms in place to resolve this problem, such as these two-tiered taxing districts. But this one allows the people in a rural fire district, they've already got a board that, you know, they trust, they put in place, that will have the mechanism to go out and say, it's up to you folks, here's what it's going to cost to have a deputy that works as a resident deputy exclusive to your rural district, and if you want it, this is what it's going to cost. The people either can vote for it or not. If they vote for it, then whatever the life of that contract, 2 or 3 years, the deputy or deputies, depending on what they want, will go out there and work, and at the end of that levy, or however they set it up, up. If the people are not happy with it, then they just don't approve it again. But it just gives some of those counties a choice. We've seen on Craigslist now, we've seen people placing ads on there. I found one, it's been a couple months ago now, where one of the rural residential areas of Lane County was essentially looking for a hired gun to come in and protect their residential area. And I think we all know how that's going to end up, when we start doing that, because the people that do that kind of work sometimes probably shouldn't be doing it. So anyway, that's the goal of this, is just to give some of these rural districts that have nothing a choice to have some law enforcement presence in the county. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I could just follow up, just to make sure everyone is on the same page as to how this would work. As Kevin has stated, basically it would take a vote of the district. The sheriff's office already has contracts with the cities of Crestwell as well as Bonita, and as they said, also with Forest Services. So it would be very similar and modeled after that. And basically, it would allow, as Kevin has also stated, and I think it's very important, this is not buying a deputy to be countywide. It is actually going to be an individual who will be dedicated and committed to that rural fire district where they have been funded to actually provide that service. Now, what will happen is that they will be available for first responding with first responders, but when they're not in that mode, they will actually be able to patrol just like they normally would have done if they had accessibility, but they will be limited to be within that district, with the exception and understanding that there is a mutual, mutual aid that if they actually needed to pull someone out because something horrendous is occurring, which they have already with the other cities that they contract with, they could in fact pull a deputy from a district into another scenario if it reached that threshold. But we're talking about active shooter, we're talking about significant major traffic accidents, something that would really require a very quick response so they couldn't get other people there, but then they would also backfill as they could.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Yes, Representative Boone.
So I was just trying to figure out how this sounds like this is more of a Lane County issue because you guys are particularly hard hit. Mm-hmm. Who would hire, I've got a couple questions here, who would hire the person, I'm assuming the sheriff's office would hire the person and dedicate them to that, and the fire district would be raising the tax money to pay that position and car and equipment and stuff, or how does that work?
Right. What's ideal about this for me is that's how we have our resident deputies set up. Our resident deputies are set up very similar program. They have a geographical district that they work. They have a citizens review group that hires them, so the citizens get to decide who they hire. It's a deputy that we already have working, already certified, already, there isn't anything about that piece. And then we provide, of course, the vehicle, the maintenance, the supervision, all of that comes into the contract piece. So the mechanism's well set up to get the thing working very quickly if that's what a person chose to do or that's what a district chose to do. The piece with it also is that it's there's a dollar figure, of course, associated with that. And again, it would be up to a district to choose whether or not they want to pay that dollar figure. Now, what's happened with our resident deputies, for example, is that the federal program that we're paying for that program with, we're going to have to reapply again. We're hopeful that we're going to get it again. But it doesn't quite cover the deputy's salary. We're willing to try and work with that however it works to try and make it as attractive as possible, because obviously that would be a benefit to the citizens of Lane County to have that law enforcement presence there. And one of the things that Marcola was particularly, they got exposure to, was this resident deputy. So they realized how valuable that was, where you have somebody that works your area that actually is in that area and can do services and is a resource for that area. And there isn't, it's a community policing model almost, in the respect of you get a resident deputy that's very familiar with that area and familiar with the people that work in that area. It works out to be a very nice collaborative relationship with the fire department and the sheriff's office. The thing that we had added to the cities and to the contract people that wanted to vendor this service is the opportunity to choose the person that they want to have working there. So it's a process. a selection process, if you will, so the citizens get to choose who they have, as opposed to just the most senior or just the, you know, some other mechanism. It's, they get to, the deputy actually has to vie for that position and want to have that spot, and then have the opportunity for the citizens to interview him or her to see if whether that's their fit. And the cool part that I have is the sheriff, there's so few cool parts, is that I have deputies that want this spot. They want to be in this position. This is, this to them means a little more freedom, a little more opportunity, a little wider breadth of assignments. So it's a vied for spot. So usually you get people that really want to do this.
Follow up. Kind of sounds like it's a, like in a fire district, when you go out of your district, say your district line is on the street, yeah, and you go out of it because there's a fire burning here, right, or a bad medical, bad fire or wreck or something. When you're out of your district, if you're not covering yours and something happens there, then that's the problem. But so if they're dedicated to this one area and understanding there's mutual aid with the rest of the sheriff's department and there's a big event somewhere in the other end of the county, how does that work? Does that dedicated deputy have to stay in that district, or?
Well, again, it kind of depends on what it is. If it's a minor deal, of course not.
Yeah.
It has to be some sort of significant event is occurring where they need cover. The other thing that we've become very, very attuned to is that if it happens too often, we need to modify the contract. Either we're not having enough people or we're not having enough coverage. But one of the things that, like any vendor contract, if you're not getting your service, we want people to let us know. And we'll adjust the contract as needed. Because, for instance, the Veneta deputies, as an example, they'll get called very in close proximity to Veneta. They'll get calls that are emergency service. The sergeant that actually is responsible for monitoring that area is very cognizant of the fact that the resources, when the resources leave the city's not under the obligation to pay. And we've been really careful about trying to adjust the costs and making sure that everybody's, you know, good with that. The other piece that is attractive as far as a contract piece is that if they're gone on vacation, we can cover that, or we can write it in the contract that vacation's included. But if they're gone too long, we make the monetary adjustment for that. And the supervision piece is also kind of a beauty of that, because we've managed to, we have a supervisor that can manage the time of the deputies that are working in any given area. Like we have a sergeant that a fraction of his job is to monitor the resident deputies. So the citizens have a supervisor to call, and of course they can call the sheriff for that matter, and it can work its way down. But we're very responsive to these, because this is one of the few things we have going that keeps the sheriff's office out there.
If I could just add to that too, just as an example, in the city of Crestwell, they're kind of in Southland County, and sometimes what will happen is that we'll have a priority call for service in Southland County, Cottage Grove, in that area, and so the closest deputy may be that contract deputy that's in Crestwell. So the patrol sergeant then will send them on the call, and then they'll backfill that position with one of the main office cars. So they'll route one of the free main office cars to go into the city of Crestwell. And the other thing with this bill is that we wrote in there that it's not the sheriff, we wrote in law enforcement, so it's not exclusive to the sheriff. So there's probably some counties in Eastern Oregon that may have the ability to work closer with the state police, or they may have the ability to work closer with a municipal government agency. So it really leaves that door open to work, you know, to build that relationship. Like the city of Cobourg, you know, they're a rural fire district, but they also cover the city of Cobourg, and it may work out better for them to, you know, to come up with a contract with the city of Cobourg for law enforcement services. So we left that door open as well.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many deputies do you have?
Total? We have...
That's badge yielding, gun-carrying deputies that are on duty.
On duty, on patrol, we have 18.
Okay, I have 18 on patrol. How many do you have? Come back to the original question, Sheriff.
That if you take all of our contract deputies and
all Lane the County, ones that carry a gun and have a badge.
Right. Lane County is one of the few that the classification is the same. So deputy sheriff is a deputy sheriff. So the deputies we have working in the jail are also sworn deputies. Now, they're not working patrol, obviously, but in answer to your question, they are sworn deputies. So In total, for Lane County, we have about 113 sworn deputies that's working in the facility and working on the road.
Of that, how many is encompassed in your jail?
The majority. So, 18 on the road, and then the majority of the rest in the facility. And then we have some contract deputies that obviously the city of Crestwell, Veneta, in our marine contract, and for about 10 seconds, we have the forest deputies still working, but that'll run out also. That's one of the federal programs running out here in July 1st.
So you have about 100 deputies that are in the jail system and contract?
I'm sorry, sir, say that again.
You said you had 130 deputies?
Total, right.
Okay, but 21 on the road, so that leaves 109 left.
Captain Trapp just told me in total, because we have to include, we have deputies that are, they need to do transport, so they transport the prisoners around. They specifically work courtroom security or court security. You have the patrol deputies, you have the contract deputies. So our apportionment is about, I don't know, where it would be a third and two-thirds?
57 in the police division, and then the remainder of those would be in the corrections.
And the rest in the corrections, okay.
So you have 57 total then in the police division.
Yeah.
And it takes 21 to do 24/7?
Right, they have to do all
for
that.
A week?
Pardon me?
It takes 21 deputies to do 24/7 for a week?
We don't do 24/7. We do 16 to 18 hours.
I understand that. So you only have 18 out there. But if you had 21, you could do 24/7.
Oh, potentially. We could do more. At the two and a supervisor for a 4,600 square mile county.
Yeah. Thank you. Follow up?
Just one moment, Representative. Sheriff, if you could give us the name of the captain for the record.
Oh, Byron Trapp.
Byron Trapp.
Captain
Thank
of
you.
Police Service.
Thank you, sir.
Yep.
And
known as Captain. Sheriff, when we take this individual, we allocate it to a region. Are they allowed to deviate much from that? Because, you know, to me, what happens to the area that they were patrolling? Do you hire someone with additional staff? Is that what your plan is here?
No.
Because they've had to have vacated. There's got to be a vacuum someplace.
the rest of the county. Unfortunately, what it is this provides coverage for that geographical area. And then, as was asked earlier, we'll come up with a specific criteria for why they would leave their assignment. You know, what is the call that they would go for? And again, that's immediate emergency is what it currently is right now, where officers need cover, it's a major collision, it's a, you know, shooting, some other event that they have to leave. Other than that, they're obligated to serve their contract, whichever that geographical district is or whatever their assignment is, because that's what they're obligated to do. And the thing that we've learned, and I've certainly learned, is that if you don't hold to the contract as specific as you possibly can, you're going to lose that contract. And that's why all of our contracts are year to year. And we've had to modify them as we go through because we want to keep the work.
Thank you. Thank you. And Representative Parrish.
Okay, and I'm just going to try and sneak at it because I got a committee hearing and I'm waiting for my text, but it's my turn to go. Just two questions. They're kind of tied together. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking through the OLIS system here, and it looks like fire districts are not in favor of this, which I'm kind of curious to hear what your perception is of what their issue is. But then one of kind of my bellwethers on things coming over from the Senate, Betsy Johnson was a no, and I'm curious what was her concern. She's just kind of somebody I watch how she votes on certain things and trust her vote on certain things. So I'm curious why she was a no on the floor for that bill.
Well, I'll answer the first part that I know about, and I'll hand it to Senator Pozanski. Again, I felt that we've enjoyed a good relationship with our rural fire districts. That's the majority of the time that the Sheriff's Office spends with is the rural fire districts. The concerns that I have heard, anyway, is that the Sheriff's Office was trying to get use of this money or, you know, control of this money. That isn't the case at all. It's a contractual relationship that if they wanted to, if a person wanted to enter into it, great. If they don't, great, and we move on from there. The other piece, too, that I think was misunderstood is that it was the sheriff's office. It's a law enforcement opportunity. So if you wanted to have law enforcement, as Kevin has mentioned, City of Cobourg, for instance, has a municipal department at closer proximity than we do. Then the sheriff's office might have access to it. We also don't have any. If it works, great, and if it doesn't, great. It was a possibility for one district. That's all we were looking at.
Mr. Chair and Vice Chair Pierce, I can't answer the question for you as to why Senator Johnson chose to vote against it. What I would tell you at the time, more than likely it was based on the association that had come out. And as the sheriff has said, first of all, I don't think everyone read the bill as to exactly what it provided for and what it would require. And as I stated before, we took it out of the committee on the Senate side, I offered to put in the Dash 1 amendment. And at that point, they said they just didn't like the bill because they thought this was a way that the sheriffs could actually obtain access to funds that they thought there was more privy to what they would need. And sitting down and speaking to them, it made it as clear as I could that the levies, bonds, the funding that they already had would not be touched by this because, as I understand it, those were passed by the voters providing for emergency fire and medical services, and it was penciled out for that amount. And so that is why this one here should, in fact, leave a lot of the concerns that people would have, because part of the statute would require a separate vote for the district to get authorization to contract with whoever in the way of law enforcement. Now, when you look at the bill, it does require that there be some cross-jurisdiction there. So in other words, you wouldn't have someone from Bend, Oregon, contracting with someone out of Lane County because they are not overlapping in jurisdiction. So you have some, let's say, keeping it close to home approach. And so basically, as the sheriff has stated, using the city of Cobourg, there are possibly three different entities that the Cobourg Rural Fire District could contract with. The closest would be Cobourg. The second would probably be the sheriffs. Third would be the state police. But all three of them have jurisdiction over a portion of the fire district, and that would be the only requirement. So you wouldn't have people being contracted from some distance away to come over. I think the other part that's important from one of the other questions that came forward is that, I think it was Representative Esquimal asked about the staffing. My understanding is there are 18 that are actually out doing patrol. Some of the others in police services have other obligations, so they can't be out on patrol unless you're going to short other areas. And specifically, I can tell you as a former assistant district attorney in Lane County, without having the sheriff transport units, you would not be able to move prisoners back and forth from the jail to the courthouse to actually do that. So where you might say, well, you could nip here, you could tuck there, there's other obligations that this department has. But this was, again, something that Mohawk came forward because they actually have, and I don't know if it's it has run now, but they do have a resident deputy, Mercola. Has a resident deputy, and they see, because that funding is getting ready to run out, they wanted to see how else could they do this. So this is going to at least have one rural fire district having the tool in their toolbox that they can then ask their voters if they want to continue that type of specialized service.
Thank you for that. Any further questions of the panel? So, Senator, I respect your time greatly. I just have a couple quick questions about the amendment, and I appreciate the Dash 1. So a vote would be required by the voters of the district to enter into the contract. Would the same vote be required for a renewal every year? Is that what you anticipate?
I think what it would have to, I would say yes, that's more than likely how they would write it, because they would probably write it on a levy basis of how long it was going to be in existence. I do believe if their attorneys from the rural fire district wanted to have a broader perspective, they could say, like, for a 5-year renewable on a yearly or annual basis. So I don't want to mislead the committee, because I think that the you know, the rural fire district is going to say, we probably want to be able to plan for the future. We want to know that we can actually have stability through this process, but we will want to have the revisiting that the either side can pull out on an annual basis.
Thank you for that. And I'm also curious, do you find that having the election itself would be somewhat cost prohibitive? It would cost money to hold the election, therefore, who pays for that?
Mr. Chair, what I would expect is that if it was going to be a special election, the rural fire district would be on the obligation for that. What I would expect, though, instead of having a special election for just this particular issue, it would go out on a regular scheduled time for a ballot, which could be, as the chair knows, not only during the primary or general, but there are special times. In fact, there's one that's right now in May that's up that you could see it going on to one of those minor election cycles.
Thank you. And then, you know, because I, being a firefighter, actually being former law enforcement, I was, you know, police for 11 years. I worked for the city of Gresham 26 years now. So I think I understand why some folks have some anxiety about this. From a firefighter perspective, they're concerned about the firefighters raising the dollars, but the police department are going to be directing the dollars. So law enforcement will use the dollars for their purpose, but basically on the backs of the firefighters, for lack of a better term, popularity in a community. I say that with great respect here to law enforcement as a profession. I think firefighters are worried that the districts have raised the money and we'd be able to reach back into those funds. And to be honest, we talked about a governing board, in fact, your comment about a board, but you could actually steer that board in a way where you could have, yourself included, could run for the fire district board as a retired sheriff's office, and now you are pro-police on a fire district board, and you can start diverting more money. That's the concerns. Now, I think that the amendment is a great step towards trying to solve that, give that to the district. I have a little bit of concern about that. So I think, you know, I want to look forward to working with you, Senator, and talking to you more about this. We're in a public hearing today. We didn't ask for a fiscal analysis on the -1 amendment. We don't have that yet, so we can't do anything with the bill yet. We don't want to kind of continue the dialogue as we go down this course, because you had mentioned that we're talking about the vote forward. And so I guess, in your mind, do you see the vote accompanying a dollar amount? So citizens are in my mind, the way I see it is that the question would be, do you want the fire district to enter contract with the sheriff's office? Not for X amount of dollars, because I think that you could use your existing funds as worded. Are you anticipating that there would be a different dollar amount, meaning in order to enter the agreement, it would cost us X amount of dollars for the officer?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, the way I would envision this would be probably a bifurcated two-step process. I think the first question would be whether or not they want to enter into the agreement. Then I think you could have either on the same ballot, based on the negotiations that had taken place before it went to the ballot, what that cost would be, which would be a separate one, or you could have a requirement that they be a two-step process. I mean, that's something that can be done. It's unfortunate to hear some of the concerns that have been raised. I know not only to you, some of them were raised to me, as to thinking that somehow this is how law enforcement, quote-unquote, is going to commandeer money away. I mean, the reality, I see this, that the individuals that receive the service from the rural fire district is going to have the opportunity to say, yes, we're willing to pay for a deputy or a state trooper or a city officer that's within our jurisdictional area to actually provide police services that we currently don't have. And for me, if I was living in one of those areas, I would know I actually have someone there where, unfortunately, the sheriff for Lane County, and if you go through all the other rural counties that we have that are having the issues through the ONC timber counties, they don't have anybody even put out there, let alone placing them in any geographic area.
No, I understand. And again, seeing both sides of this issue, I have been in the rig waiting for, the scene to be secured and staging. And I imagine if you're in a rural community, which I'm not, that can be a very long, lengthy wait. Mm-hmm. I think where there's some disagreement is whose responsibility is to provide the protection to the community. Is it the firefighters, fire district, to provide law enforcement, or is it the law enforcement agency themselves to provide to the district? And that could be a little bit of the, but again, willing to work with, through this with you and have these conversations.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that. I look forward to working with you, and I'll just say that I think it's one of those questions that we need to step back and see who's going to get the services, whether it is a rural fire district for fire and medical or if it's law enforcement. It's the individuals in this case who are going to be voting, and there are some individuals that would say, yes, I would like to make certain that we have that type of coverage as compared to what we've heard someone going out on the internet and looking for a hired gun.
Fair enough. Thank you, gentlemen. I really appreciate that. Any other questions for the committee? And Senator, thanks for your time today, and Sheriff as well, and congratulations on your retirement.
Thank you.
Stay safe. Thank you. And next up, we'll be hearing from the Fire District and the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association. So, Genoa Ingram and Nicole Palmateer, please.
I can't find it.
Good afternoon, ladies. Welcome to the committee. You've been through this routine before, so you can start as you wish in whatever order you desire.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. Genoa Ingram, representing the Oregon Fire District Directors Association today. The Oregon Fire District Directors Association is the association for the elected officials who oversee the duties of the rural fire protection districts. There are usually five members per board, and they serve without compensation. And I'm going to go through a little bit of history on Senate Bill 422 with you in just a moment, but I want to start by saying the OFDDA does strongly oppose the Senate Bill 422. The key reason that I've heard from the fire districts is that there are already mechanisms in place, which Nicole will address in a moment, that if there are shortages, the voters can vote to do such things as pocket levies, which are successfully being voted in various areas. But I came into this bill just by way of history. After the bill came out, it just so happened that there was a conference for the Special Districts Association up in Portland, and I had looked at the bill. I didn't, you know, I hadn't really read it thoroughly. It didn't seem like a big deal to me. It seemed like something that was enabling legislation. You can choose to do it, or you can choose not to do it if you're not interested. And so I really didn't have an opinion on the bill. And during the fire caucus up in Portland, I went through the list of the legislation that we had seen in February, and the questions all focused on this particular piece of legislation, and they wanted to know, you know, what was the deal? Why was this needed? And why, you know, is already being done successfully through pocket levies, and so why is this particular piece of legislation needed? And it got very controversial, and I was instructed at the end of the fire caucus, which was held on a Friday, to go back over the weekend and do a call down of all of the fire districts in Lane County. And I spent my weekend talking with fire districts in Lane County, fully expecting to hear pros and cons about why Senate Bill 422 was needed. I called Coburg Fire. I called Lane County Fire and Rescue, Siuslaw, Mohawk, McKenzie, Cottage Grove, you know, just to name a few. Like I said, I spent most of my weekend and not really knowing what to expect. And what I heard was that I could not find a single fire district in Lane County that supported it. And I got to one fire district, Mohawk, and the individual that I spoke with said, oh yes, I was the one who attended the town hall and I suggested this mechanism for funding, because apparently Mohawk used to have a resident law enforcement official that was who was funded through federal dollars, and that funding went away, and so they were looking for a way to fund that position. And so he says, well, I suggested it as a way to get the conversation going, but upon more discussion, Mohawk does not support this option at this time. And as I found, as I went down the list and spoke with each fire district and department, I could not find a single district that supported it. Now, the reasons varied. Many said this is a public relations nightmare, because as it is now, fire districts usually are able to pass their levies fairly handily, and you know, special districts are very unique in that they are a unit of government that are set up to provide one service and one service only, and they do so very affordably. They are concerned that if they are required to collect funds and then disperse them for other types of services, that undermines what a special district really does. There was also concern that it would pit law enforcement against the fire service, much like, you know, we see cities having to choose, you know, to fund where to put the funding, whether it should go to law enforcement or the fire or other types of services. There was also a great deal of concern that some of these very rural fire districts don't have legal counsel, and they were very worried about the types of contracts that they would enter into. Would they be put in a position of having to indemnify law enforcement if they didn't have an attorney to look at that? What kinds of contracts and what kinds of problems were these little rural fire protection districts going to get themselves into? We heard a moment ago, they said if people aren't happy with it, you know, they won't approve it. Well, right now, by and large, people are happy with the fire service. Fire service and law enforcement provide valuable services. I think it's a matter, though, of the fire service being able to more handily pass their levies and, you know, the opportunity then arises to look, funding other types of services. There was also a comment that came up about, you know, and I don't know how serious they were, but they said, well, you know, we use water a lot, you know, to fight fires. So are we then going to have to fund, you know, water districts? And there was just a lot of concern about collecting money from taxpayers that is supposed to be used to fight fire and use it for something different. I will close there, but I can tell you that as of today, I wanted to point out one little thing. There, hopefully in OLIS, you should have a letter from the Lane County Fire Defense Board. That's a number of public or fire service agencies, and they meet monthly. And they took a position back in February unanimously to oppose Senate Bill 422. Again, as of today, I have, you know, going into this whole discussion with an open mind, I have not been able to identify a single fire district in Oregon that would support using this mechanism. They believe that that the mechanism already exists through other means, and I am happy to respond to any questions should they arise.
Thank you. Ms. Palmateer.
Chair Matthews, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Nicole Palmateer here today on behalf of the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association and Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, and I apologize for not putting that on the witness sheet. I will not rehash the comments. As Genoa pointed out, there are a lot of concerns among the fire service. Chair Matthews also expressed a lot of the concerns that we've heard from across the state. As Genoa pointed out, there are mechanisms in place that allow pocket levies to be ran right now to fund these kinds of specialized services, and we've seen those successfully pass in Clackamas and Washington counties. Speaking to a variety of different individuals in the fire service, they have worked together with law enforcement to be able to help any way that they can to make sure these things are available. We do have a current system in place that allows for these kinds of specialized funding to happen, and that system should be preserved. So with that, we just add our concerns along with the fire district directors to Senate Bill 422, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions of the committee? Yes, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. General, I'm just interested if you know of any instances in recent history where fire district personnel have shown up to an event and have been victims of a personal attack, assault, that sort of thing.
Through the chair, Representative Witt, not in Oregon am I aware of such occurrences, although unfortunately, as you know, it is happening in other states. I also represent the Volunteer Firefighters Association, and this was a discussion that I had with them because they're really down in the trenches more than the fire district directors. And so the volunteers and the career firefighters, and in speaking with the volunteers, I asked them if they felt this was necessary, and the board of directors of the volunteer firefighters, they were adamantly against this. And I asked them too, I said, now I heard during testimony that some of you are carrying weapons in, and is this true? And they, across the board, said that they had not heard of any of their colleagues taking weapons into a situation. I do want to say, though, that when I surveyed the various fire districts and departments, they all felt that they already had an excellent collaborative relationship with law enforcement. And in the event, if there was a, a shooting or some event such as was described earlier, that law enforcement is already there and they already cooperate very well together currently. And if I may, there was a question about cost in my survey. I had asked if anyone knew what this, because I had no idea going into this. I was just calling and looking for information. One of the districts I spoke with said that he estimated that it would cost approximately $150,000 per deputy, and there was a great deal of concern when some of these rural fire protection districts are near compression already, that they just felt that it wasn't feasible for them to do. Thank you for letting me get that in.
Thank you.
Any further questions? And I want to point out, too, and I can take the other side of this, which is going to be odd for a minute, but I want to let you know, as I see it, it would take the fire district board to approve to recommend this to the voters. So you'd already have, you would have your board have to approve this first and then send it out to the voters. Is that the way you understand this? And again, I'm going to play devil's advocate, so just bear with me.
Mr. Chair, that is absolutely the way I understand it.
Okay.
However, what the directors that I spoke with are concerned about is that there are some areas in the state that are lacking law enforcement, and they don't want to have to take the blame for not stepping up and coming up with some other mechanism to fund this other service for right. their constituents.
I understand. And the other thing is, back to my comment originally about There is a huge difference between a firefighter on the scene and a police officer on the scene with situational awareness, the safety of the scene, the vulnerability of the individual, and also the use of force escalation. And so, I mean, there are times where firefighters are sitting out waiting for the scene to get secure. So I understand what we're trying to accomplish. I understand why a certain part of Oregon might be a whole lot more rural than I'm used to and that I even understand or comprehend. And that's why I'm committed to continue to try to find exactly where this thing goes and how we get there with respect to the men and women doing the job so that they're not left out there in a situation where they can't help. Their citizens need them, but to do so would compromise their own personal safety.
Mr. Chair, I'm very concerned about that as well. As I said, I represent volunteer firefighters. I certainly don't want to see any of them injured. I can tell you, though, that there are pocket levies that do work currently in rural Clackamas County and Washington counties, and those work very well, providing additional law enforcement services where needed.
So as an example, just give me an example of a pocket levy instead of just the terminology. Give me an example of a pocket levy you know now that's fairly recent that we could look to as a model.
Oh, golly.
The term sounds great.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, when I spoke with Chief Coons, he mentioned in Washington County, in particular, the voters can approve additional law enforcement personnel to serve specific areas. And I apologize, that's about as much as I know about a pocket levy, other than that is the mechanism that is being used both in Clackamas and in Washington counties. Okay. And I'd be happy to do further research.
That'd be great. I think if we're gonna refer that as a tool to use, we should probably know how it would work. And I would appreciate that very much. And thank you for that. Senator Pazanski, you're making your way here. It looks like you'd like to take a seat.
I guess two things, Mr. Chair. When they talk about pocket levy, what we think they're talking about is a special district levy. In other words, they're creating a special district. Now, if that's not it, we'd love to see what that is. And the other thing I have not heard in their testimony today as to their position with the Dash 1 that actually puts the check and balance in place that we offer to them on the Senate side that they rejected as to whether they polled their members after the Dash 1, because the polling that she shared with me was before the Dash 1 was even created. And I told you when we did that.
I appreciate that, Senator. She did allude to the $150,000 mark of the cost of an officer, which would be towards the election itself. Did you want to respond to that?
Mr. Chair, the Senator did very kindly offer amendments on the Senate side. I don't know what Nicole's process was, but I took it to my board, both the volunteers and the district directors, and they discussed it and rejected that offer.
Thank you for that, and we'll be in touch, and I'm sure we have space on our calendar and we'll continue to meet. So we're okay. Any further questions? Yes, Representative Vesco.
I assume that a pocket levy is the same as a short-term serial levy? Is that what you're referring to?
Mr. Representative Esquivel, that is my understanding. It's not my understanding that it is a special district.
It's totally like you have your district budget and you have your district levy, but this is beside that as well.
That is
and
my
it's for a duration of time.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and again, I think for me it comes down to the service of the community in whatever capacity and whose responsibility is to provide which level of service. And, you know, are we at a point where we want to have the fire districts decide if they want to provide law enforcement? And we'll figure that out. I'll be meeting with the senator and we'll be in touch and there won't be any surprises as we continue the process.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Representative Esquivel.
Thank you very much, ladies.
Committee.
Thanks so much. Is there anybody else who didn't sign up to testify on Senate Bill 422? We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 422. And would it be appropriate to open them both at the same time? Tom's on. So for the convenience of our next testimony, we will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 34 and Senate Bill 35. And if you would, please. And Mr. Mann, if you'd like to make your way up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bills 34 and 35. It's 34A, excuse me, and Senate Bill 35. Both deal with the Department of Veterans Affairs loan programs. Senate Bill 34A increases the number of home or farm loans an eligible individual may receive from the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs from 2 to 4 and declares emergency as effective on passage. Senate Bill 35 modifies the limit on home and farm loans made by ODVA to match the maximum loan-to-value or combined loan-to-value ratio permitted by the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs Home Loan Guarantee Program to take advantage of the loan program. It also declares emergency and is effective on passage.
Wonderful. Thank you. Mr. Mann, welcome to talk about one of your favorite topics.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Tom Mann. I'm with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and we got a couple simple little bills before you today. Senate Bill 34 and 35, as Committee Administrator alluded to, deal with our home loan program. We've had a lot of discussions both in the interim and this session regarding our home loan program and the agency's desire to broaden our ability to provide product to veteran customers in the state. Let me deal with Senate Bill 34A first. 34A started out as a bill that said we were going to eliminate the cap on how many loans a veteran could have in a lifetime from our department. Currently, there's a limit of 2. You get 2 loans. Unless there's a hardship, for example, your company moves you. I use the state police as an example where you get reassigned from, let's say, Coquille to Astoria, you could get that third loan. Senator Courtney, in our discussions in the Senate, was very concerned about that, bringing up some history with the loan department from the 80s and commissioned a work group that Senator Olson chaired. We brought in the Treasury Department and our department and had a good discussion about how we felt the agency was doing, what the burden of debt service was to the state for the current loan program, and what would be appropriate. And the number 4 came to mind, and here's how we got there. In the old days of the 80s, our loan program was a $3 billion program. It was fairly significant. As a matter of fact, it was the majority of debt service for the state. 30 years later, we're a $250 million program. We have shrunk quite a bit due to portfolio runoff, people paying off their loans, those type of things. We're a much, much smaller program. And our debt service is a smidge compared to what it used to be. So when Treasury came in, they said, yeah, we're very, very comfortable with the idea of ODVA being able to provide more loans during a lifetime. The loan program has changed also since those old days. In the old days, you could have multiple loans on the books, have multiple houses. Currently, the way the law currently sits, you have to live in the home. You can't go out and be a land baron and buy a bunch of homes under the program. You buy a home one at a time. And 4 seemed like a reasonable number because in 1945, when someone would buy a home, they would stay in that home for their lifetime or maybe buy a second home as they retired. Today, we have a very transient population. I'm 48 years old. I've bought 2 homes. I'll be 49 later this year. And I suspect I'll buy another home down the road and maybe a 4th one. We look at the Vietnam generation, which is either moving toward retirement or getting over that hump of retirement. And they're getting to a place where the kids are out of the house and they're looking
to either downsize, or as my in-laws did, they upsized. They finally got the dream home they wanted after they retired. And so we figured four would be plenty of loans for somebody in a lifetime. And so that's how that number came about. Once the work group was done, the Senate readdressed the bill, and we're very comfortable with what Treasury had to say regarding our debt service, what the job we're doing at the department in terms of doing a good job with the loan department and overseeing the new provisions that are in place both in law and administrative rule to make sure that we don't end up where we were in the 80s, and move the bill forward with a dash A that made it four instead of limited. So that's Senate Bill 34. Senate Bill 35 we've had some discussions about in the past as well. What Senate Bill 35 would allow us to do is engage in the VA home loan guarantee. This is the federal VA guarantee. How that program works is, I want to kind of simplify because there's a lot of moving parts. Sometimes when you do a loan that's not an 80-20, if you do a 90-10, you have to have a mortgage insurance to make sure that the loan itself is insured. The VA home loan guarantee is like mortgage insurance.
100%?
It's 100% loan, but they charge an extra funding fee of about 103%, 3.15 is what it is. And what that funding fee does is it pays for the guarantee. So if the borrower goes under and there's a foreclosure or something, that the loan is covered. This is what makes it attractive to lenders. But there are other provisions. For example, if you're a disabled veteran, you can get that funding fee back. If you have certain provisions that make this very attractive to first-time home buyers. One of the tragedies that I sit and listen to every day in my office is my underwriter's right outside my door. And every day he's turning people over to the federal VA. No, that would be a better loan with federal VA. No, that'd be, and we're giving away business right and left. And it's younger veterans trying to buy their first home who do not have equity. And so even though we can do up to 97%, because of their circumstances, it's better for them to go to the federal VA and do the federal VA loan guarantee. So we send them to another bank, Bank America, Wells Fargo, somebody, who lends them the money under the VA guarantee, because under statute we can't do that. What Senate Bill 35 does is it ties our loan-to-value ratio to the federal government, so that we would be able to do those federal VA loan guarantees. It's still ODVA. It's still ODVA's money. It's still all the rules we have in place for underwriting. It's still everything we do. But we will be using the VA loan guarantee as like the mortgage insurance for the guarantee of the loan. And Senate Bill 35 allows us to get to that place where we can start working with federal VA to offer that product. I'm excited about it personally because I know that when I was a young veteran, I used that program. I had no equity. I didn't grow up with any means. And it got me into my first home because I was able to do 100% loan. I was a service-connected disabled veteran, so I didn't have to pay certain of the fees. And I was able to establish credit and do things I would never be able to do had it not been for that loan. And so I'm excited about ODVA being a law for that as a benefit to young veterans to get them started on their way and it being a good product for us.
Great. Thank you. And great work, too, on, as I say, I use it as the model, but the ODVA with their foreclosure mediation and working with our veterans. So thank you for that. Questions? Yes, Representative Escobar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom, good work. We've been talking about this quite a while.
Yes, sir.
But I still don't understand why we, instead of limiting it to four, why we didn't do a monetary value. Example, okay, 1970, I bought a house for $10,000. Okay, so this is $417,000 today is the benefit. Why shouldn't I get $417,000 minus 10 for $407,000? And if I buy a next house and it's $20,000 or $30,000, whatever, you keep deducting that off, and that would be your ongoing benefit. So, because to me, I don't care whether a veteran has to leave because of the job or whatever. A veteran is a veteran, and they should be able to have that ability. The other thing is, on your loan to value, your 100% LTV, can you roll your closing costs into the loan itself? So, example, when I used to do federal VA loans for people, we would sometimes, a veteran would give $500 down for a down payment, but get it back at closing because everything was wrapped into his loan or her loan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Escobar, let me answer the first question because I have great news for you. I remember you in the interim bringing that up regarding the 417 and what we call the aggregate amount, which is adding those amounts, and it bothered me. And so I went back into the statutes and I read them and came to the conclusion that our agency for however many decades was misinterpreting that statute. So I went to the Department of Justice and we went to our bond counsel and says, We think we've misinterpreted this. We believe that the statute says we can do every loan at $417,000 instead of it being an aggregate, and they agreed with us. So currently we have redrafted our administrative rules, and we're going to a rule process so that our rules stay the same thing that the law says, which is every loan can be as high as $417,000 and not aggregate.
Mr. Chair,
yes, Representative Escobar.
So a veteran can get four loans at $417,000 per loan?
Mr. Chair, Representative Escobar, currently under our administrative rules, a veteran has a $417,000 limit. They can have two loans under the current law.
Two.
Up to $417,000. So if I do one at $200,000, you can do the next at $217,000.
Oh, okay. So it's still.
That's current law. What the law actually says is if a veteran wanted two loans, they could do both at $417,000. Now, obviously, we're not going to loan $417,000 to a veteran twice who obviously doesn't have the underwriting, the credit scores, the ability to pay, all those type of things.
Be eligible.
We have some pretty strict underwriting guidelines. And I'll be honest, the reason they're that strict is because of what happened in the 80s. We're just not going to get in that position again. To your second question, could you repeat that for me? I didn't quite get quite write that down.
When you example in federal VA, I've had veterans that I've sold them houses, and they gave a $500 down for a down payment. It was a federal VA because there's certain things that the, and I believe one of them is the escrow. They can't pay that. There was certain costs that the seller had to bear, about $1,600, but they could roll all this into a loan for all their own closing costs. And I've had veterans where we've given them the keys to their house, and they got their $500 earnest money back, is the way that system works.
Mr. Chair, Representative Escobar, I'm looking for that right now. It says the VA guaranteed loans are made to private lenders, et cetera, et cetera. VA guarantees the loan when it's closed. And there are certain costs that can be rolled in, as you're saying, into the cost of the home, but there are certain ones that cannot. And I know I just highlighted that before I came here because I had a feeling you'd ask me that. And I'm not finding. What I will do to is get this document to you that tells you exactly what VA allows and what they don't allow in terms of that roll-up cost. I think the big thing, though, is for service-connected disabled veterans, they get that funding fee back. And that's kind of a big deal because it lowers the cost of the loan, but it also lowers your monthly rate, your monthly mortgage costs, because obviously the less money you're paying on, the lower your rate is. So that's also a great deal for our service-connected disabled veterans.
Follow up.
Yes, sir.
Yes. Now, Mr. Mann, when you say disabled veteran, is that any veteran that has any disability, or do they have to be a certain percentage disabled?
Mr. Chair, Representative Escobar, any percentage.
Okay, thank you.
Great, thank you. Any other questions? Yes, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tom, I'm just curious. 80% of your loans, the bottom 80%, what figure do those fall under? Is it $200,000, $225,000? I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but just trying to see where the majority of loans are relative to the $417,000 ceiling.
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, let me spin the question a little bit and tell you what I'm seeing.
Okay.
I'm seeing loan locks right now coming across my desk between $155,000 to about $220,000.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at some of our delinquencies and the unfortunate foreclosures we have, and I'm seeing loans at the $325,000 to $350,000 in more urban areas, and that was when the market was real high, and the market has crashed. And what's happening is we are seeing people that are underwater by about $100,000 in their loan properties, and so we're taking losses on those delinquencies at about usually about $50,000 a pop in terms of what they've paid versus what we've owed. So what we're seeing now is the market's kind of readjusted. People that we're working with, they're having equity, so they're putting down. And so I would say $150,000 to $200,000 right now is what we're looking at. I've not seen a $417,000 loan come across my desk.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to recognize the efforts that Mr. Mann made in terms of going back and looking at the interpretation of that cap. And I think that the fact that he went back and found the true meaning of that cap is possibly enabled a number of people to qualify, maybe not currently, but into the future. And I'd like to thank him for that.
Thanks, sir.
Well, and it was pointed out to me, and we've heard it before, and we'll give you a chance to restate it. As far as the population goes, veterans are less likely to default on their loans than than the majority of our homeowners. And, again, it's that forced mediation portion of that foreclosure that helps them during difficult times kind of come to terms. I do know, too, that from a real estate standpoint, some realtors always cringe when there's going to be a veterans loan because they're really scrutinized by the inspection, and so they protect their veterans from those loans as well, which is, again, great service for our veterans. Representative Esquivel.
Yes. By the way, they changed that to FHA standards for VA inspections, so it's all in the same now. The adjustment part of it, when you go in to mediate with someone on their, they owe $350,000 on a house, you know that it's worth $250,000. Do we work with them to get that down to the $250,000 mark? Is that what we're trying to accomplish?
Yeah, Mr. Chair,
if they're eligible for it?
Yeah, Mr. Esquivel, Representative Esquivel, what we do in our process for foreclosures, first our statute tells us that we have to avoid foreclosure at any way we can. So we offer temporary reductions in their mortgage payments. We try to put, if they've missed a couple payments, put them on the back end of the loan. We do everything we can first. When somebody gets to the place where they're either going to declare a bankruptcy or they're going to walk away or they say, we just can't do this, we try to do one of two things first, either a short sale where they sell the property, doesn't end up on their credit or anything like that, and we end up taking the loss, but we try to do the best sale we can do in the community. Or sometimes we'll do a deed in lieu, where we'll take the property back and hold it until the economy gets a little better and move it, or just move it ourselves. And those are better ways to manage a failing property for a veteran than to just move to foreclosure. So we try four or five different things before we get to the place of foreclosure. When we get to that place of foreclosure, though, it's usually because one of two things. The veteran has simply walked away from the property and usually moved to another state and just said, we're not paying anymore, not giving us many options. There's been a divorce, honestly, and that causes a number of our foreclosures, or there's been a bankruptcy.
Sir?
Last question. Promise, Mr. Chair.
You don't need to promise me.
So you are seeing quite a number of intellectual foreclosures where they just walk away?
Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, we don't have a number of foreclosures. I think we've done, I don't know, less than 10 in the past 8, 10, 12 months, whatever it's been. So we don't have large numbers, but the ones we have, yeah, they're walkaways.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions of Mr. Mann? Tom, thanks for your work. I saw that it came out of the Senate, rather handedly, 30-0 on Senate Bill 35 and 25-0 with five absent on 34 as amended. So thanks for your effort on this and look forward to getting this scheduled for a work session.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Thank you very much. Before he goes, I just have to ask you, if you're only 40-something, how can you retire? I'm 20 years older than you, and I'm not retired yet. Okay.
You and I will talk off.
Yeah. I had to do it, Tom. Sorry.
You don't have to answer that.
Right.
Thanks for all you do, Tom.
Fifth,
I appreciate
Tom.
The
Take
work.
The
it's outstanding. Is there anybody else who'd like to offer a testimony on Senate Bill 34A as amended or Senate Bill 35? Seeing nobody else. We will close the public hearings on Senate Bill 34A and Senate Bill 35.
I do.
And with that, committee members, is there anything for the good of the order? I will be circling back with folks to talk a little bit about the issues that we heard today, find out where the committee's at before we exhaust a great deal of effort into any arena. I'd like to chat with individuals and find out where you might be on that. So thank you so much. And it's not called the caucus when it's one-on-one, sir. Is there any further discussion, anything for the good of the order, Representative Esquivel?
No.
Thank you all, and Cheyenne, thanks for being here today. We really appreciate it.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have one thing. I just wanted to remind people that we'll be having some joint committees coming up, I think, on some of the resilience issues, and please stay tuned and be involved. We're starting to gather some steam on this.
Well, and there's, you know, Mr. Ross has been inserted by the Senate Veterans Committee just to make sure that we follow through on their bills, so that's part of the plan.
Wow.
Ms. Edwards will be back next next meeting, but there is a discussion about how to attend or how to achieve that and maybe do it through joint committees.
Yeah.
And so we'll continue that dialogue, but thanks for bringing that forward, and there is some momentum. Appreciate that. In fact, former Governor Kulongoski is a part of that effort, too. So,
that's great. And, you know, we have the ports out here today, and I spent some time this morning with one of my port directors, and they're very involved, and they want to be involved in that. So it's, and it's very important. You know,
yeah, the plan is wonderful. It just needs some prioritizations, and we need to kind of go through the steps. So thanks for bringing that. I know that Cameron Smith and General Caldwell and lots of folks committed, so we'll look forward to the work. Thank you all. We will adjourn our House Committee on Veterans Emergency Preparedness. Thank you.